that's how I approach sports. It's not about winning for me or losing. It's really about seeing elite human beings make decisions under the crucible of pressure. And there's no sport in which the crucible of pressure and that individual decision making is writ larger than golf.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Golfers Journal podcast presented by Titleist, the number one ball in golf. My name's Tom Coyne, and I'm your host, and I'm excited about today's guest. It's very cool to have someone on that, I'll be honest, I was a little bit starstruck to have the chance to speak with this particular individual. It's definitely a perk of the job that every once in a while you get to speak with folks in the media or sports world, in this case, both, you know, that you really admire. And for me, Roger Bennett is definitely one of those people. Roger Bennett from Men in Blazers. You'll know him from that very popular football, soccer, whatever you choose to, however you choose to refer to it. That talk show on NBC where they break down soccer matches in Europe and here in the States as well, with a lot of insight, with a lot of wit. They do, when I say they, I would say Roger and his partner, Michael Davies, they do steer into golf from time to time. So we wanted to have Roger on, talk a little bit of golf with him, have a couple of laughs, talk about some of his experiences with golf, give us some of his golf takes, and they're certainly quite a bit different than you probably get from any other sports commentator, which is great. Roger's also going to be talking with us about his new book, Reborn in the USA, which I found to be just an absolutely beautiful story about his journey from being a kid raised on U.S. sitcoms, living in Liverpool, to getting his U.S. citizenship. If you need a story to make you feel good or make you remember what is so damn good about the United States, Roger and his calling card optimism and his energy, I think they'll do the job. In his book and on this podcast, his bright look on things is infectious. So I promise that this is a listen that will energize your morning, afternoon, evening, whenever you happen to be listening, wherever you are. But first, one thing I can think of that could brighten your day even more than a chat with Roger Bennett, a Golfer's Journal golden ticket. And not one golden ticket is out there in the universe. We've done this before. You know how this works. It's a golden ticket. It's in the magazine. But this time, there are three golden tickets. We're getting closer to the movie, I suppose. That's right. We've hidden three winning tickets for full weather kits from FootJoy in member copies of our upcoming issue landing in mailboxes this fall. Now, as a member, there is no action required to enter other than to, you know, go to your mailbox and rip open that envelope, shake it out, see what's in there. It's just another perk of being a Golfer's Journal member and subscriber. Of course, your membership has to be active, you know, so make sure that it is. We always want to make sure our subscriptions are active and current. But what you're going to get, over $1,200 in FootJoy gear. Let me give you the list here. DryJoy Select Rain Jacket, DryJoy Select Rain Pants, a pair of FootJoy shoes, half a dozen Rain Grip gloves, a dozen Pro Dry socks, a FootJoy umbrella. Falls around the corner. Crazy, right? And we'll be out there playing in the fall rains. I am actually coming to you from Killarney in Ireland. Played Waterville today in a pouring rain. And I would have given probably more than $1,200 just for the socks, to be honest. I love those Pro Dry socks, and I'm running low. So that's exciting. Look out for that ticket. And to complete your new FootJoy ensemble, may I remind everyone to keep an eye out for the new T-Series irons from Titleist. They are gorgeous, if you haven't seen them yet. New materials, new processes, and new refinements power new precision that must be felt to be believed. Each model is an instrument of exacting performance passed from Titleist R&D to Tour Pros, now to you. Really, from top down, they look like blades, which is amazing. That's the most important thing to me. You know, look, the way it just sits behind the ball and looks from the top, that's what I want to get out of it. Well, I wanted to stripe the ball as well. These just look so great from top down. And then they have a little, you know, a little bit of that muscle behind them. So I've got my fitting on the calendar. Can't wait. You've got to schedule one for yourself. Your authorized Titleist fitter will help you find the combination of T-Series models to unlock your ability to not only hit it longer, but to hit it closer too. Visit Titleist.com to find a fitter near you. Thanks everyone for listening and subscribing. And thanks to the sponsors from the pages of the magazine and their Link Soul, FootJoy, Titleist, Scotty Cameron, Oakley, and Links and Kings. And now, let's turn it over to Roger Bennett. Well, myself and Roger Bennett, I suppose. No jackets required for this one as we talk a little America, a little football, and a little bit of golf. That other most beautiful game. Rog, this is... Can I call you Rog? I feel like
absolutely.
I know you.
No problem with Greek. Can I call you Tom?
You can. I've spent a lot of time with you recently. I've been reading this wonderful book that I just got on Friday. So I've spent the whole weekend reading Reborn in the USA. Congratulations, man. Great book and number one bestseller. Is that I've been is that's the word.
That is true. I killed the publishing industry, Tom. We are number one in the New York Times bestseller list. I had a good run. I think didn't Guggenheim invent the press in 1450? had a good run, but it's all over now. It's been amazing. I mean, I will say the reception to this book from Americans, really, it's a love letter to America from a new American. I think the reception has been, all I can say, it's been very humbling.
I can imagine. Congratulations. I won't give you a hard time for knocking my book, which was on that list, knocking it straight off the list. But that's okay. Well, it wasn't just your fault. There were others too involved.
Were you writing under the nom de plume Bill O'Reilly?
I'm here in my mansion. No. But you did. You knocked him out of the number one spot. No, I just fell off the list entirely. But your book deserves to be there, man. It is such a. It's incredibly interesting. It's very, very funny. You know, there's a lot of sports in there, but there's just a great look at your life growing up in Liverpool, your love of America, becoming American. There's a lot of good stuff in there. We're the Golfers Journal. We, you know, our editorial team, when we have been talking about, we'd love to speak with Roger about any number of things when, you know, whether it be open related or golf and England related, but there's not a lot of golf in the book. So we're going to steer that way, you know, from time to time. But
it's a good job for you that I am the world's number one Kiradesh Appabonrap fan. So we got a lot to talk about.
Oh, we good, because that's all my notes were about him, which is great. I mean, let's start with golf. I mean, there's a lot to talk about here, but just are you interested in golf? What? And if you are interested in golf, what does interest you in golf? Obviously, football is a big part of your life. Both, I didn't realize what the role that American football played in your youth, but I do now. But what role does golf have in the story, if any?
You know, I will say that the book talks a lot about my love of America, how America saved me. You know, growing up in Liverpool in the 1980s, an amazing city, but a dark time for Britain, right? in the north. You know, the coal mines shutting down, the steel mills. If you've seen Billy Elliot, then you kind of get the drift. There's not a lot going on. Well, there's worse than not a lot going on. It was deep unemployment. It was a heroin epidemic. It was a real darkness. And the book really talks about how America saved my life. And a large part of that was sports. You know, I fell in love with the Chicago Bears, the Bulls, the White Sox. I'm about to go and throw the first pitch out at the Chicago White Sox this weekend. And it's like, it is just to know that 15-year-old me went to Comiskey a long, long time ago and is about to return with my oldest kid, and to be able to do that is genuinely more thrilling than I can say.
Yeah.
But it details a book about how sports was more than just about, you know, watching human beings in the 80s huff and puff around the field of play and then run off, have a cigarette and a pie and a pint. It was really about how I understood the world. And to me, you know, football is my main focus. I grew up in Liverpool, which was football mad, soccer mad.
Yeah.
But Camus, the Algerian French writer, wrote that he was a huge football fan, a great goalkeeper in his day, and he said that everything he knew about men and humanity and the values of human beings he learned by watching football. And that is that's how I approach sports. It's not about winning for me or losing. It's really about seeing elite human beings make decisions under the crucible of pressure. So in football's perspective, there's a great commentator, Martin Tyler, the legendary football broadcaster, who once told me, he said, it's just a simple, sports is just simple decision-making, and the truly great make better decisions more times than the good. You know, in football, you can pass, you can run, you can shoot when you get the ball. Those are the three things you can do. And making those decisions under the crucible of pressure is what is so humanly fascinating. And there's no sport in which the crucible of pressure and that individual decision-making is writ larger than golf. You know, that's why I utterly adore it, because for 4 days to be so locked into that transcendent space where muscle memory, experience, analysis, the intangibles of luck or whatever you have there, but focus mostly, that to me is peerless. And that's why, you know, we've been blessed to cover so many sports in America while we've been here. We started with soccer, but we do the NFL, the NHL. We have Aaron Rodgers is a regular, JJ Watt is a regular, half the NBA loves to come on. But it's the golfers that we have on that I truly adore, because they seem to understand the inside of the human mind better than anybody.
So who's making the best decisions? If sport and golf is this crucible where it's about making the right decisions, who do you think is making the best decisions right now?
Yeah. You know, I will say, it's always for me, the answer is always Barnrat. I just adore that human being. And when we've been blessed.
What's so special about him for you?
Well, I can say we covered the Open for NBC. We were in Port Rush, which was just an unforgettable moment, watching Shane Lowry. On that final day, just a magnificent human being in a magnificent moment, savoring every second, just utterly aware that he was helping an entire island make memories that they will have for generations once they get through the hangover, which I believe in many cases are still present. We did Carnoustie, which was equally remarkable, watching Molinari. With wonder. But when we started to cover golf, like, a lot of our coverage is about human emotion. We cover the experience of watching, the emotion of watching. I believe the glory of sport is that it allows you, you know, my book details the memories I have from watching the Chicago Bears Super Bowl winning season and then meeting the Bears. Those are memories that are profound, they're deep, they bond you to your friends, to your family, multi-generationally. In my case, they steered my life and ended up, you know, thanks to the Bears, me moving to America. But golf, you know, emotion, the other set of emotions is the emotion of the athlete. And so when we cover football, soccer, God, it's just given to us. Absolutely. You're an Italian singing the national anthem before the game and you are giving. I mean, you are turning it up to 11, and it is a joyous, just watching the Italian national football team sing the national anthem, that in its own right creates memories that you will never forget. That's before a bloody ball has been kicked. And so, yeah, we go on to day one at Carnoustie, and I watched the first day of golf, and I'll be candid with you, Tom, I was crapping myself. It was just, we were watching robots move around the course. You know, they miss a putt by a couple of inches. Maybe there's a slight jut of the chin, but very, very little human emotion. You know, I grew up watching Seve, who was all emotion, all suave, bloody emotion. The modern golfer, the emotion's kind of been processed out of them. And I will be candid, for the first 5 hours of the first day at Carnoustie, I was crapping myself. I was like, how the hell, you know, there's not a single emotional expression that we've been handed yet. You know, in football, I'm used to a bloody goal. I'm used to the shirt being ripped off. I'm used to the crowd, 60-year-old men just ripping their shirts off, allowing their you know, their parts to just be exposed to the bleak winter sun. Everything is glorious. There's a dance. There's a star. There's just, you know, bloody wonder. The golf less so. And then Bonrat took to the first hole. And this human being, oh, my God, he pulled out his driver and he was sweating. I mean, he was shattered. Just the act of pulling his driver out the bag was just was pretty exhausting for the man. And then he hit a stunning drive. It was exquisite. Pulls out his vape, just disappears into a cloud of smoke. And by the time he had made it to the first green, dude looked like he'd run a marathon. I mean, he was humanly shattered. I was worried. I didn't know, never mind the full 18. I didn't know how he was going to get through the first nine. And just every shot he did, just there was an emotion, there was joy, there was agony, there was human wonder, his interactions with the crowd. And Bonrat was really, you know, the first day, I think our show, I can't remember, I'll have to look up the actual percentages. I think we were probably about 87%. It was the Bonrat special, the belt, the being. And that's that kind of emotion that I utterly love. You know, I grew up watching golf in its golden age where it really broke through. And so much of my book, Reborn in the USA, is about the influences I had that shaped me as a human being, that gave me direction in my life. You know, Fantasy Island, The Love Boat, Heart to Heart, Miami Vice, massively, the John Hughes movies, Run DMC, Tracy Chapman and the like. But when I think about golf in that period, you know, I could write a book just about, obviously, it was Nick Faldo, Sandy Lyle, the British invasion that were the gateway for our nation. Like, oh, my God, we can compete. We can belong. We can win things. But that was back when England didn't win things. We had a very low self-esteem. I don't know if you know that, Tom. We still do. You know, filled with self-loathing. But Nick and Sandy allowed us to believe that we were different. And Seve obviously gave us a sense of suave sophistication and style. I still own Slazenger V-necks because he wore Slazenger V-necks. He actually looked good in them, me less so. But bloody hell, when you pull one on and you just muscle memory, the nostalgia of suave Seve. But when you think about the Americans of that time, Tom, I mean, some of the reason I realized a lot of the filling in of what America was, because I believe I was an American trapped in an Englishman's body. That has been my myth since to get through hard times in England in the North in the 80s was bloody hard. Mm. To get through hard times, I told myself I was an American trapped in an Englishman's body. And when you think of the American golfers from that period, the 80s, I mean, they were like sirens luring you onto the rocks. It was the coolest bunch of characters I've ever seen that really represented your nation, now my nation. And a lot of the way I am, a lot of the way I think about life as it was informed by those dudes.
So that's really interesting because, you know, when it comes to golf, you know, your book is very much about, you know, your love of things American. And I grew up in the 80s and man, just going down memory lane with your pop culture references and and the sort of bright beacon that American pop culture was in your life. It was awesome to read and relive those memories. But when it comes to golf, I think is that one place or space where Americans, whether we like to admit it or not, we would look to the British Isles and say, they do it right over there. And that's the birthplace of the game. And not that they're maybe even a little inferiority complex of American golf versus, you know, golf in Great Britain. So it seems like one of those things where it's hard to, would you look to American golf? Is the bright beacon that everything else American was for you? Or do you say, this is ours. Yes. We do it better here.
No, quite the opposite, to be candid. And I will say this book, it's quite joyous, my book. I think I wrote it in a dark time for America when sports shut down amidst the chaos of pandemic and beyond. I wanted to write about my love of America. I wanted to retrace my steps, how I came to love this nation. I always believe I love this nation more than Kenny Powers loves America. I wanted to retrace all the ways, the magical, you know, breadcrumbs I'd left through the enchanted forest that had pulled me from Liverpool to Lear. You know, as a kid who grew up in Liverpool, I painted a very crude painting, but I painted the Manhattan skyline on my bedroom wall with the Statue of Liberty. And, you know, I ended up living in Manhattan and I wanted to write about that magical journey of which I never take it for granted. And I did write it. I wrote the first draft. It was an enormous book, Tom. It was an enormous book. And my editor whittled it down. Thank God she did. Carrie Thornton, a great human being. But so much got cut out. And there was an entire, I mean, there was like five more NFL chapters. She's like, maybe it's a bit too NFL happy. I was like, all right. There was a golf. You know, there was a golf chapter that I've had friends call me up. This is what's been so amazing about the book coming out. Friends in Liverpool calling me up being like, I love the book. It's, you know, it's our story. It's your story, but it's our story. I'd be like, yeah. And then I hear a phone go a bit sad and I'd be like, the only thing is I'm not in it as much as I thought I would be. and I'm like, yeah, yeah, I'm sorry, mate. And they'll be like, you know, were we not good as good of friends as I thought we were? And then I realized, you know, I was like, oh, I felt a stabbing pain of agony and sadness. I was like, oh, mate, we are. Just so you know, this is like, this is not my entire life. Like, this is not a 12 volume autobiography like Winston Churchill. Like, I had an editor and she edited out hundreds of pages. You were in all of them, mate.
Exactly.
And it was true. It was true for that guy. He was in all of them. But that taught me a big lesson. Like, this is, so the golf chapter did hit the dust. But it was impossible. Two words for you in every single regard. I mean, I've got so many words for you. I'm trying to remember the entire chapter, but two words for you. Craig Stadler.
Ah, okay.
I mean, when you saw that human being for the first time with thine own eyes, and you're talking about your American inferiority, your English inferiority. I mean, God, Craig Stadler was like Norm from Cheers, if Norm from Cheers was an elite athlete. And it was in the stuff when I first watched him trundle around the course. I was just like so desperate, so bloody desperate for him to win. And just he just looked like the kind of guy that would walk into a subterranean bar and everyone would go, Craig. And you know, I love that in my athletes too. Fuzzy Zeller, Zeller and Curtis Strange. Two of the. Where would they rank for you, Tom, in the top 10 most American named athletes ever?
Most American named? Yeah, they're definitely up there.
We don't have in England, we did not have athletes. We didn't have human beings named Fuzzy Zeller, Curtis. I mean, other than Curtis Shamgod, other than God Shamgod, I can't think of athlete that probably has a greater claim on the best named American athlete all time than Fuzzy. And then the king, the true king, who really inspired me in remarkable ways. And I wasn't alone. If you have English listeners from that period, I'm sure a number of them are remembering just how bloody cool Lee Trevino was.
Yeah. Yeah. He was cool.
Was he cool over here or was he just cool to us?
No, he was cool here. Still kind of cool here.
Mate, yeah. I remember watching him going to an open. I can't remember what year it was, but it was the practice day. And I watched Lee Trevino as a kid. I must have been about 11 or 12. I got all dressed up in my Pringle as if I was going to play. And I watched Lee Trevino warm up on the driving range. And everyone else was on the driving range just spanking balls. Lee Trevino, though, I mean, the thing that I loved about him was that he just seemed to love the game as much under the crucible of pressure as a professional, having won so bloody much. I mean, people always forget that about Lee Trevino. He actually won so bloody much. But he still had the pleasure and delight and the giddiness and the fun of the game that I imagine he did when he was a kid. Yeah. He had his caddy stand about 20 feet away from him with a baseball mitt. And he would drive the ball and his caddy would just hold his baseball glove out and just catch it.
Pretty good.
Pretty bloody good. For any English kid who had grown up worshipping Steve McQueen, Hilton's the cooler king, it was genuinely that if the caddy had caught it in his teeth, it would have been less impressive. It was the coolest bloody thing we'd ever seen.
That's cool.
The English golfers didn't do any of that crap.
But I thought Faldo was pretty cool growing up. It's interesting, the dynamic. I mean, there's sort of this, there is this feeling of the grass is always greener, right? You know, if you're growing up in Liverpool and things are, you know, as you describe it, dark, you describe it as you felt it was like Mad Max in the book. You know, in America was this bright and shining light. But sometimes it works the other way as well. Like me growing up and thinking, you know, Lynx golf is real golf, and watching, you know, British players or Irish players go around Lynx courses. That to me is the beautiful thing. That's the beautiful game. I mean, it's funny.
That's lovely, Tom, but you got to know Lynx courses are really, they're not working class. They're not part of normal people's lives in England.
That's a good point.
You know, working class, middle class, lives don't really take place on the Lynx course. So they're televised and they look unbelievable and the elite golfers go around them. But when they're not there, your average human being doesn't go anywhere near them. So, you know, one of the fascinating things for me when we did Carnoustie was we tried to tell stories during the golf and then before the tournament, we were blessed to go out to the course and tell the history, the past, the narrative, the individual personality of those courses. And one of the pieces I'll never forget was at Carnoustie. They have a club, an amazing club called the Artisans, which is, they have their own tiny little clubhouse off. I can't even remember what hole it was off. It was like the 12th hole, their own. It was a lovely set, completely separate building to the clubhouse. Very modest, one room. They had their own competitions, and they were the builders, they were the plumbers, they were the painters of the area that were allowed to be artisan members. Like they played very early in the morning, or they played, you know, it was a great honor for them to be able to allowed to play this incredible course, but they also had to keep it up, maintain it. They were the guys who allowed the course to live and breathe. And look, you know, they painted the holes, they raked the bunkers, they tended to the course. And that was the trade-off. But there's a big class function at play in British golf. So the golf that I grew up playing, Tom, I love a Lynx course. Everybody loves a Lynx course, but I would never advise you to play Leigh Park in Liverpool, the great golf course where I grew up playing, where if you put your bag down to take a shot, there was probably a 3 in 10 chance it will get nicked by people running out of the rough. Your golf balls were, you know, if you hit too long a drive, which you learn not to, the ball would get nicked. And then you didn't really care about either of those things. Those were small inconveniences, your bag of clubs getting nicked or your ball getting nicked. Yeah. The real threat was incoming air rifle fire from the apartments, the flats, the block of flats that ran alongside one side of the course. So, yeah, there is the romance of the great, you can't beat a Scottish golf course, can you? But the romance my book ultimately is about the romantic idea of America and the reality of America. And I'd say Carnoustie, the romantic idea of British golf, Leigh Park, slightly less romantic reality of British golf. But that's where I learned to slice and hack my way around the golf course.
Excellent. The Liverpool. So your portrait of it is very well drawn, but it's certainly a place that you want to get out of. Do you go back anymore? And you say your friends have read the book and said they identify with it and enjoy it, and as they should. But you know, you tell some hard truths about, you know, growing up there. Is it, was that hard to do, or is it hard to go home again?
No. I mean, the joyous part of Liverpool's a magnificent story. It's a magnificent city, and it's a magnificent city because of the people that live there, who are romantics and dreamers and storytellers. Yeah. I first moved to Chicago when I moved to America, and I felt very at home there, because that city also has an overpopulation of incredible storytellers and blaggers and hustlers and wonders. And we look out to sea in Liverpool. It's a maritime city, and we dream about bigger possibilities. You got to know, like, I grew up at a time of deep transition for Britain under Thatcher, where the South really rose up and the North was devastated. And the great news is Liverpool has risen again. In the most remarkable way. When I grew up, it was a time of street violence and craziness, and the both of the football clubs, Everton and Liverpool, were mighty and powerful and took Europe And that's how we announced ourselves to the world. But it was a dark time. There was very little hope. There were very few jobs. The city was left to genuinely rot. But now, and if we heard a Southern accent, even a Southern accent, you never heard a foreign accent, but if you heard a Southern accent, you feared for that Southerner's life, you know, on the, really? If you've seen Trainspotting, there's a great scene where an American tourist goes to the bathroom and they just hear his accent. They just like, they follow him in there and they know a wallet's going to soon be extricated from his person.
Yeah. The bartender's wearing his jacket in the next scene. That's
awesome. Liverpool was very like that. And now Liverpool is a deeply cosmopolitan, remarkable city. It's refound the meaning. It's one of the most joy. It's like Nashville. You know, it's like a Vegas of Europe. It's a place people from all over Europe go. It's a university city in great demand. It's nightclubs and pubs and restaurants just floweth over. And it's unbelievably incredible. And it's astonishing to me to go back there and savor it and revel in it. You know, my kids, they go back there. I have four kids. They think it's like bloody Disneyland. They cannot wait to go to Liverpool. And I have a sense of wonder about that. As much as I do when I wake up here in New York, something I never take for granted. But it works for them, vice versa.
So if you're growing up in a Liverpool that's in that state, that, as you said, that state of transition and a dark time, if you will, and a very, you describe it as a sort of a rainy, that's the vibe I get, a rainy, dark time in Liverpool. You're a very positive person, a very optimistic, if you follow you on social media or, you know, watch Men in Blazers and, you have a such a bright spirit and you're just a very hopeful person and your book is stuffed with hope. It's definitely the American book. If you're looking for, you know, a recharge of like to appreciate our country, this country, you know, this is a great book for that. Where does that come from? You know, if you grew up, and frankly, and some of the stuff you went through in grade school as well, like, I'm like, oh my gosh, like if that happened to kids today, like you end up getting diagnosed and you end up in therapy for the rest of your life and you're a miserable adult. Like that's the path.
Yeah. But
you went through all that stuff and you came out here smiling and laughing and so hopeful.
Tom, it's very funny. I wrote a lot about going to school in England at a time where if you've seen the Blues Brothers and you know, the nuns with the rulers, I mean, we got the crap kicked out of us, mostly by our teachers who were deeply sadistic. And you'd come home from school, you know, bleeding. And your mother wouldn't be like, oh, my God, what's happened to you? Your mum would be like, oh, have you been a naughty boy again, Roger? And it was just totally standard. And it is funny. And I did tell those stories partially because our audience, when I do have given them insight into our schooling, just an English school in the 1980s, they just cannot believe what passed as normal. But the optimism question, you know, I've always thought, to be honest, I'm filled with a double dose of self-loathing. So I'm actually surprised how optimistic I am. But there's two things. Part of it is that maybe I'm more British than I care to think about, because I am bloody American. Becoming an American is the single greatest thing that's ever happened to me. But the first thing is British. I was always fascinated as a kid, and I go back there often, and I made a film for the British Tourist Board about the Churchill War Rooms in Britain, which is one of my favourite places to visit in London. If you've not been there, it's like three stories down under London, and it's where the British High Command spent a huge chunk of the war during the Blitz to try and run Britain, while London was being absolutely pounded by what was considered an omnipotent German air force during the Second World War. So I'm convinced that, you know, I learned from that in times of challenge, Tom, in times of challenge, you see the true nature of human beings. I think truly empathetic and good people step up in times like that. And so it's something that I take very seriously and have taken very seriously since the pandemic. Like through my own work, I've wanted to step up and give a sense of joy, sense of meaning, a sense of wisdom and nourishment. So part of that is more British than I care to imagine. But part of it is also, and I write about this in my book, you know, if you have, as I have, if you have stepped into a swearing in, a naturalization ceremony, which I did on on June 18th, 2018, in a courthouse in the southern tip of Manhattan with 162 individuals from 42 other nations. And when you chat to them after putting your hand up and swearing the oath of allegiance to the United States of America, and you hear their stories, mine were just escaping a bunch of beatings from some sadistic old cats in school, and a lot of late night darkness in Liverpool city centre. Theirs were escaping civil war, conflict, famine, walking across deserts, and all of us were animated by the American idea at different times in slightly different ways. The power of the American idea that gave us courage, confidence, joy, meaning, and belief. And when you've experienced that, then it does give you an incredible sense of strength and a sense of inner optimism. And I think ultimately mine, I did try and write this book with a sense of joy and a sense of optimism that I hope will prevail. That's where it comes from being in that room, sharing that experience, listening to those stories. It makes your heart sore.
It's a beautiful scene in the book where, and you sort of open the book with that, where an older gentleman is getting sworn in, everyone gets quiet, and he takes his oath, and you're listening, and then he raises his hands, and everyone, all these strangers applaud him. I mean, I got emotional with that. And such a beautiful book to remind you again of this gift that is living in America that so many of us, do take for granted. But you're writing this book during a pretty interesting time. When you can sit down, in 2019, 2020, we're going through a lot. The country's going through a lot, and it's still, you managed to write this love letter to America. Was it tough to do that? Or did you feel like, wow, this, I should have done this 3 years ago or 5 years from now. Or is this the time that I need to be saying this?
It's a great question, Tom. I started writing this book almost when lockdown began. I, as I said earlier, live my life through sports, all sports. They fill me with joy. I always joke that they allow me to feel things, meaning, loss, victory, joy, triumph, that normal people feel in real life, but I'm dead to inside. So when sports shut down, I was really bereft, as many people were, and nature abhors a vacuum. And so I started to write this book, as America, the Manhattan that I love. As I said, I had Manhattan painted on my bedroom wall, and the Manhattan that I then moved to was overwhelmed by the pandemic. It was a terribly dark time there at the very beginning. Hard to remember now, but chaos, fear, just the complete and utter unknown. And so to try and make sense of the present, I think it's a very natural thing to return to happy memories in the past. So I automatically started to try and sketch out the contours of my great love. My whole life has been built around the American idea. It's a dominant idea around which I've animated everything. And I wanted to retrace those steps. And then as the year continued to progress, the pandemic, the summer, the Black Lives Matter summer, the agony of that into the election, there were moments when I was like, oh my God, only I could be bringing out a book about a love letter to America at this dark time. And you never know how a book is going to be received. But I did write it in a spirit of joy and optimism. And there's lines in that are put as the epigraph of the book from the great American poet, Langston Hughes, who writes, "Let America be America again. The land that never has been yet and yet must be." And ultimately, that's the spirit in which I offer the book up. And then the last lines of the book are about me, speaking to my childhood friend with whom I shared the dream of America. And at the end of the year, I spoke to him. There were fireworks going off in the background down his line in London. I was like, "What are you celebrating?" And he's like, "We have an America that we can dream about again." And he said, "The whole world is better when it can dream about America." And he said, "We know that it's not perfect. No dream is perfect, but it's the best dream we've got." And I truly, truly believe that.
That's beautiful and really well said. And, one of my questions in getting ready to talk to you today and finishing the book and saying, all right, this a book that's very much about an American ideal. Now that you've been here, the question would be, did it live up to the fantasy that was in your head. There's this great line in the book, you know, life without fantasy was not worth living. And you watched Fantasy Island. And so did it turn out to just be a fantasy, or did it live up to it? And honestly, Raj, the looking at you and your life and what's happened and looking at you now, you're about to go throw out a pitch at the Sox game. It seems like it might have exceeded the fantasy, to be honest.
Yeah, I think my book is about the American idea. And the American reality is like any reality, super, super complicated. But the American idea has just animated me in such remarkable ways before I even set foot in the United States. And my great-grandfather was fleeing Eastern Europe in the 1900s and was a butcher and determined to get to Chicago, the hog capital of the world. That's why I'm obsessed about Chicago. You know, long before John Hughes sealed the deal for me with his movies, it was Chicago was in our blood. And the myth of our family is that my great-grandfather saw the one tall building on the Liverpool skyline when the boat docked to refuel in Liverpool on the way to New York, pointed at it. It was like, we're here in New York, let's go, and got off and stranded us in the bloody northwest of England. And so my grandfather, his son, who was also a butcher, when I was very little, he was my best mate. I'd go over there and play chess with him. And when he was sad, which, you know, often think life is complicated and challenging in Liverpool, he'd pick up this cheap tchotchke Statue of Liberty, this plastic green. I mean, I have it on my desk now. It's hilarious. This used to look so real to me, but now I'm looking at it, it looks like what it is, which probably cost about 50 cents back in the day. He'd pick it off his fireplace and he'd look at it with me and he'd say, "We should have lived there, Roger. We should have lived there." And so you grow up like that. And you know, for me, when I arrived in Chicago, which I did because I came here when I was 15 to visit a pen pal in the northern suburbs, and William Refrigerator Perry, who I met, told me to dream big dreams, kid. Live your dreams. I was like, oh my God, William Perry's just told me to move to Chicago. He was just telling me what every athlete tells any kid they want to get the hell away from. But I decided to move to Chicago at my earliest opportunity, which I did right after university. I moved here knowing nobody and having no family, no anything. And I will say, for me to have completed my family's three-generation dream 80 years later than my great-grandfather ever intended, even in dark times, and there's been a number of dark times, even in dark times, that's been enough to sustain me. And so, as I say in the book, there's not a morning I do not wake up and take for granted the opportunity to live where I live.
Good on you, Roger. And we all should. It's just a fantastic book. Everyone should check it out. Reborn in the USA, makes you feel good. Makes you laugh a lot. Makes you feel good about a lot of things, mainly that you didn't grow up in Liverpool during the 1980s, but other things as well. And before we let you go, just I'll test your as an American citizen, put you on the spot about your American bona fides.
Thank God I've already passed that test.
No, I know. But so Ryder Cup is coming up, my friend. Yeah. Are you? Give us a little, are you Team Euro? Are you Team America? Where do your allegiances lie?
Tom, what do you imagine? What do you imagine I'm going to say to that? I am all in on, I've got my American flag. I've got my signed baseballs from Hank Greenberg and Sandy Koufax. I mean, look around me. This is like,
I know the background here. I mean, you've got five Budweisers there. I mean, yeah, your name could be, or I think they're Budweisers.
They're Lionel Messi. When he broke the goal record, Budweisers, God love, that's what's called. You can see I've got a Chicago Bears signed Super Bowl 20 football. I am always, when England play America, all in on Team America, all in. You know, when for instance Alex Morgan and play her US women's national team play against England in the World Cup semi-final, and she scored and sipped tea, mimes, no one like that more than me, you know, just, oh God, take that, Piers Morgan. It's glorious. And when you for me, when you become American, it's just it is the, I hope, I do hope, I write this in the book, that in my grandfather's dining room, there's tons of photographs of past relatives, including one of a very thick-necked man who looked barbarous. And I'd always point to him as a kid and be like, "Who's that, Grandpa?" He'd be like, "We don't know his name. No one can remember his name. But he's the one, when the Cossacks came to kill our family, he killed the Cossacks. That man is the Cossack killer." And I always used to love hearing him say that. And I hope, Tom, that in six generations' time, my headshot is above my descendants' dining room table and their kids will point to it and be like, "Who's that bald bloke?" And they'll be like, "Oh, we can't remember his name. No one remembers who he is. All we know is he's the one who brought the family to America." And that to me is just the defining act of my life. So whenever the Ryder Cup is, whatever the sport, always Team America.
Damn, that's so well said, Roger. Thank you so much for the time. We wish you all the best with the book, and maybe hopefully, you know, when for any number of reasons, we would love to have you back on the Golfers Journal podcast. You're the best.
You're amazing. I really appreciate it. It's a joy to be here. And I want to thank particularly Lee Trevino. Wouldn't be here without you, Lee.
There you go. Shout out to Lee. Be well, Roger. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Courage. Thank you so much, Tom.